Good evening, this is Dr. Dan Guerra on this Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is the fourth day of April, 2024. We're going to have lecture number 12 on inflammasomes, but we're not going to be talking about the specific biochemical phenomena, perhaps at all, in this lecture. Last lecture, I introduced to you several concepts and a means by which to evaluate these mosaics. And remember, the mosaics I'm doing is just another means to approach the refereed published research in fields of biochemistry, molecular genetics, epigenetics, immunology, etc., all of which could be generalized under a description of biomedical research. And the mosaics are important because I've been doing lectures for well over 35 years in my career. And there is a time and a place where lectures have to be laid out very formally so that we discuss things like thermodynamics, bioenergetics, cell biology, molecular genetics, and then, say, molecular pathways, and then finish with a general discussion of signal transduction cascades, and then some biochemical physiology. And that could be a semester or two semesters, actually, in a graduate program, medical program, pharmacy program, etc., for biochemistry. And that's absolutely a fundamental way to teach biochemistry, and it should be continued. But if you're taking another source of obtaining biochemical knowledge, I argue another approach is to go at it by revealing the complexity of the biological system, so that we can go in and out of clinical discussions, regulatory mechanisms, enzymatic mechanisms, and all the possible vagaries and components that relate to biochemistry in the living system, including how the research is performed, how the hypothetical deductions are generated, how the experiments are designed, how they're executed, how data is generated, how evidence is essentially abstracted from the data and then formulated into a synthesis, which sometimes can be called a discussion, and then moving on and making an induction to generate a new level of understood and at that level approved knowledge base on that subject after the incorporation of the new material that you obtain by reading the literature. And that's what these mosaics are doing. So I feel compelled to address some of the epistemological and metaphysical and therefore ontological perspectives. We want to understand the living system as it is existing. So we want to know the truth of the system, and that requires an approach that leaves no stone unturned. Because if we bracket off the specifics and we just get general about pathways, or we just introduce a discussion of, say, an inflammasome, the one component we've been looking at, and we don't really get into all the various ways that inflammasomes have been studied, and then the full composite, the corpus, if you will, of all the different biochemical interactions that one protein platform in the cytosol interacts with, just when the inflammasome is involved in a discrete component of inflammation in a cell. And then relating that, of course, to tissues and organs and the entire system, and in our particular current interest, that system is, of course, the human biochemical domain. So I'm going, the reason I don't feel any guilt in talking about the epistemology and metaphysics and therefore the ontology is because one of the components of being a professor is educating people on how to learn the discipline of which they are sitting down and taking notes upon. And part of that can be imparted by a professor who's been doing it a long time and then trying to transfer at some level his or her knowledge base to his students. Okay. And so that's what I'm doing here. Not saying we're going to do this all the time. I really love just talking about, you know, metabolic pathways. I really love talking about kinase cascades, gene expression, epigenetic modifications. I love all that mechanistic discussion and thermodynamics as well, bioenergetics as well, all of it. And I'm not going to stop doing that. Well, you know, authentic biochemistry is going to proceed from these mosaics. I'm just giving you an idea, if in case you tuned in recently, that these mosaics are not something that we've done before, even though I do get into a great deal of the ontic effects of the biochemical systems we're reviewing from the published refereed research literature. Okay, so that was a long introduction, but it wasn't that long, right? It was only, what, 6.5 minutes. That's not so long. But now, hopefully I have your attention, and we're going to proceed with a deeper discussion that we finished on last time. So the working title for this lecture I decided is Biochemical Mosaic 3, Inflammasome, Chapter 12, or Lecture 12, and then subtitle, The Synthesis After the Firestorm. And the firestorm, of course, is the inflammasome, right? So let me proceed. Our self-owned knowledge is how each individual obtains his existence in the world. That makes our knowledge base and the means by which we apprehend it extremely valuable asset. And this necessarily requires we are very careful about that knowledge base, and this truth requires that we maintain it by updating with new intuitions. By that I mean sense data, plus our full faculties of reason, including conceptual understanding, idea-based imagination, and the third element requiring our agency, the intralocution. Now, this tripartite sequence, I would argue, is phenocopied within the dialectical event ontology I've been developing over the last couple of years. Now, that's where our genome is in constant sway with our changing environment. And that obtains our knowledge via the means of the third component, which is the immunoepigenome. So the immunoepigenome is constantly rewriting the interaction of the genome with the environment. That doesn't mean that it's all a matter of mutations, not at all. It has to do with epigenetic signatures into the genome, altering gene expression, and therefore everything downstream from that relative to the interaction with the environment. So it's a tripartite. And if you want, you could even imagine that the immunoepigenome is generated by that interaction between the genome and the environment, you see? And I can come up with a better term for it, but right now I think I will use that term because I've been using it for a while. And plus, I'm sure you're tired of my new terms. And I'm not one that wants to generate new terms, you know, like exergective and instance. I'm only generating them to try to develop more clarity of what my approach is towards this subject matter that I've devoted my life to, at least my professional life. So let me continue. We wake up every day, and what are we doing? We're reestablishing who we are and how we live. We choose to be the person that calls upon the resource of self. And so we undeniably choose to not merely fulfill, but constantly create anew that self-identity by willing our renewed becoming into and onto the world. So that requires our free choice of our will, and thus expands the form of existence. So I'm an existentialist, right? But that expands the form of existence to what I have termed instance. That's the term I have. Now, when your life resembles, I'm going to get a little metaphorical here, a calmly flowing stream with no ironic twists or turns or potentially paradoxical obstacles and, say, rapids to obtain, you're either living without spirit or you're on the brink of a 1,000-foot rocky waterfall. Okay? So there's no calm flowing stream as you live through your existence. You are an agent, so you're freely willing that existence, and that I call instance, right? So one of the core original virtues that has been described is courage. It's given some serious examination in the beloved dialogue of Plato called Laches. And his student, only one of them actually, Aristotle, also weighs in his perspective. And that's, of course, in the Nicomachean Ethics, Book 6. And there he describes the merits of courage as a noble virtue. So those are some references you may want to read sometime. Laches and Nicomachean Ethics, Book 6. Now, I want to say that courage is dying, or more honestly, becoming almost purposely asphyxiated in our modern times. And this determined destruction could mean the very annihilation, or at least the great sequestration, of the human spirit. I argue you simply cannot efficiently exist without courage, as its vacant self-denial turns one's free choice of the will to stone, and the world into, probably, for those that would go that far, a gallery of horrors. So each of the virtues are necessary in their own domain for a good life. And few would argue against this proposition when evaluating their own conscience. But there is a critical difference between acknowledging a truth and living that truth. And what that involves, of course, is mere existence. So existence, though, is not a predicate. It does not appear as a condition or property of life. It instantiates life itself. Existence is indeed self-insistent. So when courage occurs in an existing individual, it discloses that individual for how he lives, and in that way becomes an ontological structure that defines the individual's becoming, and is thus what has been termed in the older literature existential. Right? Think about Heidegger. Now, to sharpen the lens, I intend to replace structure with action to allow for the requirement of an event ontology rather than a substance ontology worldview. And of course, that is a derivative of Whitehead's philosophy. So see, I'm giving you the references. Now, thus my new term for existential becomes instantial. reflecting the eventuating agency of the ontologically existing individual, which is basically reality. So the self instantiates his living in time, and the output is his instantial, including any virtue he agentically events into existence. There I'm using the word event, of course, as a verb, right? Now, foundation of the sharpened worldview is that virtues are instantials. Potential instantiating actions of the subjective, or now we can call endojective, inwardness, and thus the ownedness of any individual who freely chooses to be virtuous. So it has nothing to do with social structures and everything to do with individual personal defining commitments. So in my view, being courageous, for example, always expanding and annotating your knowledge base is a very courageous event in your life. So being courageous is necessary to become a fully realized human being. However, even that is not sufficient. In order to achieve ontological full personal realization, one must choose all of the classical virtues. Now, a good discussion of this would require, of course, a thoroughgoing examination of the non-arbitrary meaning of each virtue, instantial, and that will be developed, and I am writing that in an opus, in a book I'm writing. So I'll just say here elsewhere. But for now, I'll leave you with the concept of instantial pairing and the requirement for sudden inbreaking into the world from previous well-composed disequilibria. So disequilibria, or disequilibrium, single form, is a non-steady state, perpetually becoming uncertainty in the free will-driven world. When I look at the remaining virtues, the obvious instantial pairing to courage is wisdom. Thus, I propose that courage is informed by wisdom, and wisdom is demonstrated through courage. So you cannot be wise if you aren't bold and brave, because there is no eventuality to wisdom without that agentic suddenness embodied through courage within the individual. Simultaneously, you're not courageous unless you wisely event your courage suddenly to the world. So courage and wisdom pair up to help cause the world around the individual. And only the existing individual can create his world where courage obtains and wisdom guides from soul to spirit. So since knowledge is JTB, justified true belief, and I do hold that as a good definition, and some have argued against it, and of course you're free to do that, but since knowledge is JTB to me, I argue that we justify this belief precisely because it is true. So there's no place in my philosophy or my understanding of research science for nihilism. There is truth, right? So no nihilism. So the truth-preserving nature of the premise maintains that functionality and further establishes the belief of self-aware free will. Why? Well, because it accounts for our existence as perpetually becoming in the world. I'm not saying being in the world, because that's a finished product. And I get that concept of being a finished product from Soren Kierkegaard's philosophy. Okay. Just because I want to reference all of my input, right? Now, free will is reliable, sustainable, and preeminent in our daily lives. The determinist perspective requires a substantial amount of faith in the unknowable, whereas free will is a fundamental structure and event of our knowledge gathering methods. How else does it come about, you see? Because free will allows both the internal and external nature of our metaphysical paradigms. What I consider to be real and existing in space and time are endojectively rendered through the empirical acquisition process, coupled with the higher-minded faculties of reason, which we've already covered, understanding, imagination, and what I'm calling intralocution. Now, what the factual scientific worldview supports is the acquisition of truth-preserving fundamentals. I didn't call them universals, I called them fundamentals for a reason. Fundamentals are structural and functional derivations of the world at large, thus becoming events. So the verification process of hypothetical nullification requires a dialectic which serves as the method for explanation and acquisition of new knowledge. Each step in this process requires polar, by that I mean yes, no, moments, hence a dialectic, you see, of decision making that are necessarily the output of free thinking and free choice. All scientific practice can essentially be distilled to that pure fraction I just laid out. However, the scientific paradigm of law governing natural cosmos has been undermined to some extent, naively, I would argue, by quantum mechanics. Now, why would I say that? Well, uncertainty, which I love the term and I love the concept, uncertainty in the structure of matter, the subatomic level, and now demonstrated at the macromolecular level using small-scale pulse-resonating instrumentation, has demonstrated that the universe is neither predictable nor is it linear. Now, that's not to say we cannot predict and generate extension of matter and energy transmission through discrete wave particle accelerators, or that we can't demonstrate reliability and consistency in predictive thermodynamics, because we can. So what this apparent paradox, and it's only an apparent pseudo-paradox, demonstrates is that we have no orthodoxy or law governing physical universe that by its very nature violates the rules we impose upon it. In biology and even in chemistry, we in the field are well attuned to the flexibility and unpredictability of systems, even when they're highly controlled. Indeed, at the cellular level, not only does mutation occur essentially stochastically, thus generating an ever-changing biological future, but even within stable somatic tissues. Indeed, no cells are identical. If you've never thought about that, think about it now. Now, alternative mRNA splicing, either intragenically or at the 5' or 3' end, will generate a population of protein expression patterns that are super variable, and further, this lack of uniformity is actually, yes, necessary for survival of living systems. Since no two cells are identical, even though they possess the same genetic material, more or less, rather than causing a breakdown of homeostasis, the heterogeneity provides the fluid dynamic mechanism event by which living systems engage in ever-changing internal and external environments. So if the proteome metabolome were completely uniform, any sway in transcription, translation, and metabolic control via hormonal signaling, covalent modification, intracellular sorting, any of those mechanisms we talk about all the time in orthotic biochemistry, well, that would direct the entire mass of tissue, if they had common cellular identity, to almost identical fate. Now, that would constitute an all-or-nothing response. And that would not only promote massive destruction of whole organs, but also limit those very organs to be predisposed to respond differentially. Therefore, at the cellular level, predictions are only approximations. And uncertainty is the rule, not the exception. Since biological systems also work under certain conditions, just like when we talk about conditions for chemical reactions, but far more elaborate, this generating plurality of metastable states provide no determinant coordination. So cell fate is not destined. So there's no absolute necessary or universal principle guiding that or any other biological process. Cellular life exhibits its own form of free will, not consciously, because it lacks consciousness, but it chooses metabolic output and exists at a meta autonomous individual cellular state. So the term choosing is obviously metaphorical, right? But that's what's occurring in the cell population. There are metabolic outcomes to cellular responses that are unique to the cell. Okay. So there's not pure determinism in any living system. So let me check my time here, because now we're going to get more deeply into the metaphysical level. Yeah, I think I'm going to stop here. I'll leave it with this one statement. At the metaphysical level, the ordering of time might serve as the determinant worldview. Okay, so I'll leave you that to ponder. So I'm not finished, obviously. I guess we're going to do another lecture within this particular domain of discussion. And if you don't like this kind of discussion, what you can do is pass on these lectures and metaphysics, epistemology, and wait until I get back into a new mosaic where we're just doing a review of the published research. And that'll happen soon. Dr. Dan Guerra, Thursday afternoon, 4/4/2024, saying bye for now.